Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is an encore edition of Soundcheck. One producer called them the sound of rock music being destroyed. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and coming up on today's show, a look at Sonic Youth and their 25-year-long mission to deconstruct rock. Also, veteran producer and songwriter T-Bone Burnett talks about his own mission to save high fidelity in recorded music. More than 25 years after they formed here in New York, Sonic Youth is experiencing a bit of a moment in pop culture. These influential noisemakers are the subject of a plot point in the hit film Juno, a touring exhibit of band memorabilia, a track on the Guitar Hero 3 video game, and a CD compilation to be released at Starbucks. Yes, Starbucks. And now there are two new books out about Sonic Youth. Music writer David Brown interviewed the band for his biography called Goodbye 20th Century, and he joins us in our studio. David, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thanks, John. Glad to be here.
What is going on here? A band that never had a true hit, suddenly, it's like a perfect storm of pop culture coming together here.
It really is, and I think it's just a completely accidental way that everything happens with Sonic Youth. They don't really kind of plan these things. I certainly didn't plan for my book to be part of this perfect storm either. It all came out of the blue. I just think it's just a symbol, or a sign, I should say, of how they're still on a lot of people's minds, even though they've never had a hit record, never had a hit song. They've been together now 27 years. And I think, in a way, it's all their recognition is finally kind of kicking in. People are realizing, oh, yeah, they're still around. They're still kind of doing what they do. Daydream Nation was voted into the Library of Congress Registry of Recordings a couple of years ago, and that was one of the first signs that they were becoming an institution, which
right.
is kind of funny.
And in typical Sonic Youth fashion, this year is the 20th anniversary of Daydream Nation, but last year is
exactly.
the year they went around touring the whole album.
Exactly. Everything's a little off with Sonic Youth. Starting with the guitar tunings, everything's a little out of whack.
So explain, I mean, let's take the moment in Juno. Why is it, quote-unquote, cool for Justin Bateman's character to like Sonic Youth? Why is that a plot point in that movie?
That character is kind of a loser character. It's unfortunate, but I mean, he embodies that indie rock diehard, that guy or woman in some cases who kind of grew up with this music in the 80s, and it's still the music that speaks to them the most. And I think that's really important with Sonic Youth, because their emergence and a lot of other bands from the late 70s, early 80s, signified a real paradigm shift in rock, in that they were really approaching things in a very different way. They were not starting with the basic building blocks of pop music, you know,
right.
R&B, blues.
Well, as you say, they often started by retuning their guitars
exactly.
to see where it took them. We're talking about the band Sonic Youth, and here is that musical moment that occurs in the soundtrack to the film Juno.
Baby, 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 baby.
superstar from the band Sonic Youth that appears in the soundtrack and in the film, Juno. And again, everything with Sonic Youth has a twist to it, and this is not a Sonic Youth original, but their cover of a song usually associated with the Carpenters. My guest is David Brown. He's author of Goodbye 20th Century, a biography of Sonic Youth. As we bid goodbye to the 20th century and are now in the first decade of the 21st century, where do you continue to hear the influence of Sonic Youth?
You hear them in a lot of new indie bands, the bands like Black Dice or Wolf Eyes or whatever, who are kind of experimenting more with noise elements in it. But I think what's interesting about Sonic Youth is that I think they're one of the most influential bands in rock history, but not in the traditional ways. There aren't a zillion Sonic Youth copy bands. I think their influence is felt, especially these days, as much in the fact that they're still around, they're still doing what they do after all these years, and so younger bands look at them and go, oh my God, they're still around. They started as this scrappy Lower East Side band who used power drills on stage, and 27 years later, they're still together. Without having a hit record, without having a hit song, I think that's kind of inspiring to a lot of people. And the fact that they're using all these other models to make business models to make some extra cash, like a Starbucks thing or a soundtrack thing. That's a symbolic change also.
Well, I mean, they're certainly not the only band from that era that's still around. U2, of course, the Stones, even going further back. God help us, the Eagles. But what's different? What gives Sonic Youth that kind of that ring of authenticity? The fact that they're still out there, not reliving their past, even when they are in fact playing song for song their Daydream Nation record.
Well, I think the fact that they're incredibly productive. I mean, they do put out a new record every 2 or 3 years. When they go tour, they usually mostly just play new music, and they'll sprinkle in a couple of old songs. When you go see Sonic Youth in concert, it's not an oldie show, except for that Daydream Nation tour. That was a real exception for them, and there were a lot of debates within the band as to whether even to do that or not. Some of them did, some didn't. So there's a sort of like, let's keep moving forward aspect to that band. And so I think that's one of the things that's made them still relevant.
Well, now they came out of, as you say, the kind of lower Manhattan scene, late 70s, early 80s. That was not necessarily strictly a rock scene back then.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about the whole gestation of Sonic Youth.
The origins of Sonic Youth are so tied in with that period in New York in the late 70s that, I hope this isn't true, but it seems like the last great period when you had this confluence of music and art and all these different worlds kind of coming together in this really wide-ranging community. It was the last time when you could be a sort of fringe artist, whether you were a painter, a sculptor, or a musician, and kind of come to New York and get a cheap apartment and somehow eke out a living. And there was all this cross-pollination. You had artists like Robert Longo were in bands.
Right.
Sonic Youth were not just musicians, but they would have little art installations at galleries like White Columns and so forth.
And if you think of a place like The Kitchen, which we still today think is one of the bastions of the avant-garde. I mean, Lee Ranaldo and Thurston Moore, the guitarists, they were regulars at places like The Kitchen back then.
Right, and it was kind of an amazingly fertile time. You even had like hip-hop. Fab Five Freddy was hanging out down that scene. And of course, Blondie used hip hop, right around that time in one of their records. So it was a really fascinating period.
Well, we're talking about the band Sonic Youth. Last year, in fact, almost a year ago today, Lee Ranaldo, the guitarist and vocalist from Sonic Youth, told us here in the studio exactly what was happening at the time that Sonic Youth was formed.
Well, we were coming out of a lot of different places. We were young, middle-class white kids. We'd been educated, college educated in sort of like modern art theory and things like that. And we were putting together a lot of different things, from love of garage music and the punk scene and coming to New York when Thurston Kim and I did the no wave scene and the new wave bands and no wave bands, as they were called. And just a lot of different ideas from a lot of different places that were floating around in the early 80s in New York. Everybody's talking about the stormy weather. What's a man to do but work out whether it's true? Looking for a man with a focus and a temper who can open up a map and see between one and two.
The song Teenage Riot is from the classic Sonic Youth record, Daydream Nation, an album now 20 years old. We're speaking with David Brown, who is the author of Goodbye 20th Century, a biography of Sonic Youth. David, you heard Lee Rinaldo mention the No Wave movement, very brief movement here in New York.
Absolutely.
Late 70s, early 80s. In fact, Thurston Moore has a new book called No Wave, Post-Punk Underground New York, 1976 to 1980. We started by quoting a producer who called Sonic Youth the sound of rock music being destroyed. That producer was Butch Vig, the guy who produced Nirvana, a couple of the Sonic Youth records. Is that accurate? Is that what Sonic Youth was about, kind of deconstructing rock music?
They were, although it's kind of funny. They weren't to the extent of the No Wave scene, which really was. I mean, the No Wave scene was, we're just, you know, we can play one chord over and over again for like an hour and do some screaming or whatever. And although it's funny, you listen back to No Wave records, they sound kind of normal. It's funny, but...
at the time, though, it seemed very conceptual.
It did. And Sonic Youth had those elements, but as Lee said in his soundbite there, they had those bits of that traditional rock element in them, you know. Lee was singing Crosby, Stills, and Nash songs as a teenager. So, but the way they merged all those worlds together was really unique at the time. Kind of still is.
Are we hearing any echoes of that in some of the more experimental? I mean, you know, Cross the Bridge into Williamsburg. Is there any bands there that are kind of doing that sort of experimenting?
There are, although it's kind of funny, you know, indie rock, you know, when you think of indie rock these days and Arcade Fire and Broken Social Scene and like the big bands, they're a lot more twee to me than Sonic Youth ever were. And again, I think it's Sonic Youth's influence is almost more on some grander kind of level. You know, you look at all the people that they brought along with them into the culture, young up-and-coming musicians, artists, movie directors, you know, it's from Kurt Cobain to Sofia Coppola and Spike Jonze and directors like Phil Morrison and Todd Haynes and artists like Richard Prince and Raymond Pettibone. These are all people who were operating on some, you know, under the radar level until they hooked up with Sonic Youth, and Sonic Youth kind of brought them along with them into the mainstream. And that's been as much their influence as an actual, you know, sound.
Well, I mean, just, you know, Kim Gordon, the bass player from Sonic Youth, she was the one who got Nirvana signed to their first record deal with Geffen Records. So that's a major influence right there.
And she hooked up Spike Jonze and Sofia Coppola. She was the matchmaker. So there you go.
All right, so we'll pick up that thread and perhaps discuss also the curious phenomenon of a Sonic Youth record at Starbucks when we continue. David Brown is my guest. He's author of Goodbye 20th Century, a biography of Sonic Youth. And then coming up later, T-Bone Burnett, the producer and musician, talks about the decline of fidelity in the age of MP3s, and he'll share his new solo CD. That's coming up later on Soundcheck. We blinded all we saw. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. More now with music writer David Brown, author of the new Sonic Youth biography called Goodbye 20th Century. You can also check out my blog post on the Soundcheck page, wnyc.org, and you can post a comment there. Tell us what you think of Sonic Youth and their legacy, their influence in the music world. David, before we went to the break, I mentioned, you know, Starbucks, you know, Sonic Youth at Starbucks. Not their first time in the sort of mainstream market. They signed with Geffen Records. What was a major record label thinking, signing Sonic Youth?
It's a crazy thing to think that there was this moment in time in the early 90s. It just shows you how crazy everything was when a major record company actually thought Sonic Youth could become sort of pop stars. Of course, that was after Nirvana, and Sonic Youth signed to Geffen before Nirvana. But I think that was the start of a moment in time where you had a lot of young record company executives at the end of the 80s. People who had come out of indie rock were suddenly working at big labels and were saying, you know, maybe the future isn't just John Mellencamp here. You know, maybe there are all these other bands. Let's try to, you know, get some of those in the big leagues. And Sonic Youth was sort of a, you know, kind of a guinea pig in a sort of way. And they had an interesting ride. You know, they worked with Butch Vig, as you mentioned earlier, made a pretty commercial for them record called Dirty, and that mm-hmm. was they had their little flirtation with that, and it didn't quite, you know, get any bigger than that, but you know, there was this weird period of time when people at Geffen Records were calling Sonic Youth the next Nirvana, and it's hilarious in retrospect.
Well, especially since they had never heard of Nirvana until Sonic Youth said, hey, here's our signature on our contract, maybe you should send a contract to this band in Seattle.
Exactly.
So 100% was the quote-unquote hit single.
Right.
The hit single it never was.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, look, people yeah. heard it, and yeah. some people bought it, but in the grand scheme of things, didn't make much of a dent. But this was the quote-unquote commercial Sonic Youth.
Chick is mine. All I know is you got no money. That's got nothing to do with a good time. But can you forgive the boy who shot you in the head?
From the 1991 album Dirty, that is Sonic Youth. And the song 100%, that was supposed to be a hit single for them. And David Brown is my guest. Go ahead, David.
Oh, sorry, but the very beginning of that song, you hear this like little piercing feedback.
Yeah.
When the label Geffen released that as a single, there you have a radio edit was just to cut that out.
But so. They couldn't get rid of the squalling feedback, distorted guitars that
doing
run through the
chorus. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I kind of like that a major label took a chance and signed this band knowing that this is what they sounded like.
I know. It makes you nostalgic for the record business.
But the other question is, they didn't just drop them.
I know.
Sonic Youth stayed with this label forever.
Right?
I mean,
right.
How did that happen?
Well, you know, part of it was that thing called a contract. But, you know, that helps a lot. But, you know, I think after a certain point, especially after the record business started to kind of crumble in the late 90s and that label in particular started dropping bands, Sonic Youth had reached such a level of credibility, and they were still alluring younger bands in a way to record companies like that
so
it would have been embarrassing.
They were already a legacy act.
They were already, exactly, a heritage act, yes, as they were called. And to drop them would have almost been an embarrassment for the company.
All right. The book is called Goodbye 20th Century, a biography of Sonic Youth. David Brown is the author. They spoke to you.
They did indeed.
You know, they all sat down. Did they present a kind of united front when it came to decisions like signing with a major record label, staying with a major record label, going for the pop hit?
Not a united front at all. These are four very different people with four very strong opinions, and they're an incredibly democratic band, which is really interesting about them. That's everyone I've talked to who also worked with them, from lawyers to record company people, kind of said the same thing. They always had to check with all four of them. They all wanted their input. You know, Steve Shelley, the drummer, told me he was the one who was most resistant to signing with Geffen because he'd come out of the hardcore scene. He was an indie label kid. The idea of, you know, where's all this money going to go? You know, those kind of questions. So they all kind of like take a vote, you know, and mm-hmm. Mary Street was supposed to be called something else until they took a vote and, you know, changed it to Mary Street. So.
Well, now, Thurston Moore and Thurston and Kim have been married, I guess, for most of the time or all of the time that they've been a band. So that's an added.
It'll
kind
be 24
dynamic.
Years actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's a dynamic that has to be accounted for in the internal discussions in any decision as well.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a certain, you know, it's funny. There's a certain power block there with the two of them, but at the same time, they disagree on things as much as they agree. And I think they're really conscious. Even from the early days of the band on tour, they would be very careful not to be sort of lovey-dovey and, like, make out in the back of the van. Yeah, like, they would not do any of that. They wanted to make it really professional and business-like. And that's another interesting thing about Sonic. They've always been really focused and directed, and they're not a big sex, or I say drugs and rock and roll band, sex, but they're not a behind the music waiting to happen. They've always been very together and moving forward, and like let's not.
This is one of the big questions for you, David, having written a 400-page book about this band. Is how do you make a 400-page book when there isn't sex and drugs and rock and roll? You know, when there isn't a whole lot of dirt to be dished out.
Well, that presented a certain challenge, but I mean, I think what their story says, you know, about the rise of this kind of music and where it went in the 90s and the like I was talked about earlier, the kind of people they brought along the way, to me, that's all as fascinating as, you know, your kind of cliched, you know, drug overdose tales. And to me, that was refreshing. You know, it was one of the few stories in rock history that it doesn't fall into all of those cliches, and it's sort of perfect for Sonic Youth. They're not a conventional band, and they definitely don't have a conventional story.
Well, but they do have one sort of conventional thing, or at least, you know, Beatles fans will recognize this paradigm: one band, two songwriters. Mm-hmm. One of them a little more pop inflected, and the other a little more art inflected. The former being Lee Ranaldo, the latter being Thurston Moore. What kind of tension did that set up within the band?
Well, it's interesting with Sonic Youth. One of the things they always pride themselves on is that they kind of write these songs together, and I think they see that as a real collaborative effort. And I think there has been tension over the years, especially in the early '90s. You know, Lee was kind of bringing in his own songs. They were a little more. They were a little more poppier, a little more maybe conventional than the ones that Kim and Thurston write. And so that actually did create a real moment of tension in the band in the early 90s when, you know, Lee felt he wasn't being heard enough in every meaning of that phrase. And so, yeah, that was actually a difficult period for the band.
All right, a couple of comments from Soundcheck listeners. We've got Peter in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, writing, Sonic Youth managed to make beautiful, delicate, aggressive music that was both catchy and experimental, but why, that's five whys, did they always choose the worst bands of their time to tour with? So they picked Nirvana. They did pick a hit, but they did not have good taste in opening acts, according to Peter. Another comment from someone who describes him or herself simply as huge fan of Soundcheck. I think the early influence, she's talking about Glenn Branca, etc., is heard through Thurston's career with Sonic Youth and his solo stuff. I loved it then, and I love it now. It has never grown old for me. The band has not compromised much through the years, and that is what earns them so much respect. So they came out of this art scene with people like Glenn Branca and Rhys Chatham doing their symphonies for electric guitars, and they still kind of are comfortable in that world, it seems.
Yeah, in fact, Kim Thurston Lee played with Rhys Chatham last year in Brooklyn, recreating one of those pieces. So they still still adhere to a lot of that, and absolutely true. I mean, the fact that even when they were on Geffen and making quote-unquote commercial records, they were still really much very much themselves, is as much their legacy as anything.
All right, now, here's a dissenting view from Liz in Midtown. I never got Sonic Youth. I bought their albums in the early mid-90s because it seemed like the thing to do if you were a literate-minded music fan, but the music's unlistenable, pretentious, and not much fun. Sonic Youth is the bitter spinach of my music diet.
That sounds like the girl in Juno. That's exactly what she... It's a longer version. Version of that bit of dialogue.
All right, so the band is still doing what they do. They are now doing it at Starbucks. I mean, you know, we should say this is a compilation. Right. It's like various famous people picking their favorite Sonic Youth song.
Right,
but still, this is their democracy. They had to vote to do this, right?
Right. There was even up until when I was doing some of my last interviews with the band for the book, which was last fall, there was still a lot of head scratching, like, is this the right thing to do? Especially when word leaked out and there was a lot of internet chatter from fans going, oh my God, you can't do this. And it made them think, gee, you know, is this the right thing to do? But, you know, why not? You know, I mean, I think, they were finished with their contract with their label. Why not get the music out that way? It seems like it's legit. Starbucks seems like as good a label as anybody else these days.
Given the state of the industry, not a bad point. David Brown is author of Goodbye 20th Century, a biography of Sonic Youth. David, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, John. Great to be here.
And still ahead on Soundcheck today, veteran musician and producer T-Bone Burnett refuses to see High Fidelity die without a fight. He joins us to talk about sound formats that are superior to both MP3s and CDs, and he'll share his latest solo album. This is Low Direction. Prepare for the city. You're listening to an encore edition of Soundcheck.